Well, those of you who have ever had a class with me, or maybe even a lunch for 10 or 15 minutes, you probably heard me say something like, by the way, it's really hard to keep my focus as I look around the room and I say, oh, and there's. So I'll try to wait till break time to actually talk to you. So anyway, you've heard me say something like, stay curious, and then elaborate that with use your ignorance. Revel in your ignorance. Notice all that you don't know about what you're hearing and seeing from the person sitting across from you. Give him the honor of that compassionate curiosity. Well, I realized recently that only works if you know that you're ignorant. And recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, I discovered an amazingly large blind spot in my life. And it's a great ignorance there, but I was ignorant of its presence. So it was like if I, you know, look through a telescope and or something and saw a black hole out there. And that ignorance that I've been reveling in since has to do with multicultural things, has to do with diversity. So that's what we'll be looking at today, and we're going to take the focus of that diversity and shine it on, so to speak, on couples. So you have a few handouts for me, and one of them says an overview page. Let's start with this overview page and a word called Latasha. Oh, I'm so glad you two are here. Which I might as well say this now, this nice moment that Latasha and Elena are sitting here. They neither of them are old white guys. I am an old white guy. You know, when you read those chapters on feminist therapy, and it finally dawned on the field, through women, of course, that all these theorists were old white guys. What about women? What do they know about women? And that the spirit of that has moved forward to look at various minority groups. There's great improvement in considering diversity in the field of counseling and marriage and family therapy. So it's rather daring of me as a 63-year-old white person to be talking about minorities. I've been a majority all my life, and thus the blind spot. So as I see these two ladies sitting here, and I've already talked to a few others of you, I am welcoming your input during this presentation. Please don't feel badly at all if you have a comment, if you have a correction, gently, of course. But I welcome it. And I specifically asked for an extra microphone so that would facilitate you making comments. And I'm going to put it on Aaron's table. So it's right here in the middle. So when you would like to make a comment, I'd like you to just get up and walk over there and pick that thing up, and we'll deal with it right then. Well, I want to talk to you about a word here on this overview page called racialization. It is a palatable word for me, maybe more palatable than racism. There are probably quite a few of you in this room who have read a book by Emerson and Smith called Divided by Faith. Would you raise your hand if you've read Divided by Faith? A couple of stragglers out there. Well, that's good. At least I'll be sharing new material with many of you. I highly recommend it. And They're folks that I keep running into that deal with diversity from a Christian perspective keep recommending this book. It's getting a little old now, but it's just... that's John. but it's in what many ways like it's right off the press. Well, rather than that might mean that I'm not supposed to walk out beyond some speaker point. So the word racialization is used actually in place of racism. And for good reason, as I'll explain in a moment. So let's look at some general concepts here. Let me explain to you some of the awarenesses that I've discovered. This I'm going to tell you about my own personal journey here. So racialization, a racialized society allocates economic, political, social, and psychological benefits along racial lines. And racial, of course, when we speak of racial, we're talking about persons categorized primarily in terms of physical features. When we talk about ethnicity, we're talking about persons categorized primarily in terms of cultural differences. And that they overlap a great deal and sometimes are used synonymously. Another author, and here's a book that some of you would have certainly read. The title of it is very catchy and clever. Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? That's the name of that. How many of you read that? Yeah. Well, this author really refers to the same phenomenon, but she doesn't pull any punches. She calls it racism. And she defines that very simply as a system of advantage based on race. Well, when I hear someone say that our society is racist, and Bill, you partake in a racist society, or even you partake and contribute to a racialized society in America, I bristle a little at that. At least I did at first, until I ran across this sort of information. Let's look at these 10 items together. Since 1950 to the present, the black-white unemployment ratio has been about the same as 2-1 for every one unemployed white person in our culture. There are two black persons, twice as many unemployed. Median income, this is fascinating, isn't it? Of 62% of white income is what black income is, if you look at it overall. And of course, I have a little note there. Median is less skewed by outliers. That's why average isn't used. You get that that's more centralized summary of what the numbers represent. But that hits me pretty hard, that the median black income is 62% of the median white income. Median total asset amount of black persons is 8% that of white persons. So if you look at holdings like houses and cars and bank accounts, on the average, or generally speaking, I should say, if you're a black person, your holdings are 8% that of the general run-of-the-mill white person. That starts to get uncomfortable for me when I hear that. That's not fair. The next one is even more shocking. Median net financial assets. This is not looking at possessions. This is just looking at financial holdings of some sort of bank account. The black financial assets are 0% of what would be $7,000 for the run-of-the-mill general white person. Now, how could it be zero? How could, does that mean, it doesn't mean all black people have no money? No, it means some of them are in debt. Many of them are in debt. That's why it comes out to a zero figure. But in terms of when you look just at financial assets, generally speaking, the white person has $7,000 compared to $0 of the generally speaking African-American person. And for some reason or other, I am actually more bothered by item number 5. Median net financial assets of college-educated black persons look like this. $175, as opposed to the median net financial assets for college-educated white person is $20,000. So, go to college, get an education, and generally speaking, an African-American person will have a savings of $175 as opposed to $20,000. Now think about your car breaking down. Think about having to go to the hospital. We're going to look a little bit later at the community collectivism nature of black culture as opposed to white culture, and we'll find out that there's more of a close-knit care and financial care for one another, and even persons that are larger in family of origin, and that almost always, well, I'll just say this, and there's a higher incidence of catastrophe and calamity in their general family of origin and extended family network. So the funds are needed. Of course, there are African American people with more savings than this, but when you look at the whole picture. Now, these stats were actually pulled together around the year 2000, so we could hope that they are getting better, but they're not. Actually going in the other direction. I just ran across an article recently, and it'll be referenced here eventually in one of our handouts, that I think it was either 213 or 214, and the title of the article was the wealth gap between the white and the black in America continues to widen. We'll see what that's all about. Well, here, I'm going to move out of the financial realm. Look at item number 6 here. White persons are 89% more likely to receive coronary bypass surgery than black persons. This is a particular hospital study in Massachusetts. Same study, and white persons were 3 times more likely to receive surgery at all than black persons. I guess they were just that much more healthy, right? I guess the black persons just were so healthy they didn't need any surgery and there weren't any heart problems. I'm being sarcastic. Nobody's responding to that. Okay. Of course, I don't know how you should respond to that. Black mothers 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white mothers. Black babies die at a rate over twice that of the frequency of white babies. Black young males are 6 times more likely to be murdered than are white American males. Hello, Stephanie. Yes, she does.
I promise you I don't.
I'm getting pretty old.
Another question for me is,
Marty, make
the present 1950 to the present, and then you said something about the year 2000. So is this from 1950 to 2000, or is this current, say in the last 2 or 3 years?
This statistic comes from the Emerson and Smith book, so it is 12 or 13 years old, that one in particular.
Okay. And how were those numbers generated?
I can't go any farther than that.
Okay.
Stephanie. Is there something you're thinking that you'd like to kind of add to the mix here in the conversation?
Oh, yeah. A lot of times these studies are always biased because of where you're getting your information from. Who are the people that you're actually, this is not even on, who are the people that you're actually doing the survey with? Who are the people, where are they, what geographic area are they from? So what I want people to understand that this is always skewed. So when you're looking at these numbers, they're not going to be accurate. And they're always going to be skewed based on who you're surveying. So that's what I want people to understand when they're doing this.
Once upon a time, taking a statistics class, I believe it was Wheaton College, there was a little movie that the teacher brought in, a movie in stats class. You got to be crazy. That's amazing. I'll stay awake today. And it was called Statistics Don't Lie. And it was a beautiful demonstration of all the ways in which statistics can be reported and manipulated and so forth. So, I don't. Are you thinking that the picture on this particular statistic, Stephanie, probably looks better for African Americans, or probably looks worse for African Americans, or you don't have a clue? You're just saying be careful about trusting it.
I'm saying two things. One, I'm saying being careful about trusting, mm-hmm. and then you have a particular study that's in Massachusetts.
Right.
Okay, and so that's not going to be transportable across the country. So if you take that statistic and look at it and try to generate it and say journalize it for, say, Mississippi or California or somewhere else, that's not going to be correct.
No argument. You must be careful with statistics. I think, though, that we can find enough statistical evidence and recent statistical evidence, as I said, I have some other pieces coming up later that are much more recent. I think we can find enough evidence to say that the black experience of America is not the same as the white experience of America.
True.
Yeah.
And did I do that kindly enough?
You were kind. When have you ever been otherwise, Stephanie? Stephanie actually invited me to her church to do a couples communication seminar on a Wednesday night, and it was that long ago, over a number of Wednesday nights. It was the best attended couples communication seminar I've ever done at a church. The people came out of the woodwork, and it was lovely. All right. Well, as I began reading these things and talking with friends of mine who are African American, and I will say here at Reformed Seminary, because of the African American Leadership Initiative, which has been going on now for 5 or 6 years, it's an effort to reach out to the African American community and offer more theological education than they usually have available to them. I suppose we could say it this way, that RTS is trying to educate pastors to the same degree of Stephanie's pastor, Brother Jerry Young, who actually graduated from RTS, though he be a Baptist through and through. And so as a part of the African American Leadership Initiative, we have more African American students here on campus, and we've had more African American students in the Marriage and Family Program. And so I've hung out more with African American students than I had in the past, and asked them questions and tried to not ask offensive questions. That's a little scary. And I learned some things over these past few years. I actually joined something we have here at the seminary called a cohort, which is a diverse group of students. They let me come in to the first cohort, although I was not a student. They let me come in and participate with the students. And the blind spot for me was being shown up more clearly. I was learning a great deal about the people that live right down the street from me and the people that have lived right around the corner from me all my life. Let's look at another word here. Let's look at the word whiteness or white privilege. Now, some of you who are white might be bristling at this moment, as I think I have in the past. What do you mean I'm privileged? I'm not so privileged. I work hard for my family and my livelihood, and things aren't that easy. And well, let me talk about it a little bit. The concept that whites in Western societies enjoy advantages that non-whites do not experience, as one author puts it, it's like an invisible backpack of unearned assets. White privilege denotes both obvious and less obvious passive advantages that white people may not recognize they have, which distinguishes it from overt bias or prejudice. These include cultural affirmations of one's own worth, presumed a greater social status, freedom to move, buy, work, play, speak freely. The effects can be seen in professional, educational, and personal context. The concept of white privilege also implies assuming universality of one's own experience, seeing others as different or exceptional while perceiving oneself as the norm. Yeah, I'm the norm. I'm the baseline. And you hear statements sometimes like, wow, to a black person, you sound just like a white person. Wow, that's great. A woman was sitting in my office one day and said, she was a black woman and about my age, and she was taking a class. She was a lawyer, and I asked her, "What's it like to be a black woman in Mississippi? And can you tell me? Can you give me some understanding of that so I know, you better?" This was many years ago, and she said, "There are these little." She said, "I don't run into racist people that are bigoted, dangerous kinds of persons in my world." But she said, "There's something called the microaggression or micro offenses that occur." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, like if I'm meeting someone for the first time." And the woman I'm describing to you, if I haven't already told you, she was a practicing lawyer. And someone says in a social setting, who's a white person, "Hey, what do you do?" By the way, or sometimes a black person too, but what do you do? And she says, "Oh, I'm a lawyer." And she said the response is, "Wow, that's great." And she said, "Now, if you said you were a lawyer, they would say, oh darn, let's get away from him, or great, or how many kids do you have? Life would have, or they might have told a lawyer joke or something." But for her, it was like, "Oh wow, look at you! You've really come a long way, haven't you?" And she said, "With that, she said that's offensive. Little offenses like that." So we might as well look at that next piece while we're talking about racism and privilege. The term microaggression was used by Columbia professor Gerald Sue to refer to brief and commonplace daily verbal behavior or environmental indignities, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate perhaps hostile or derogatory, or just some negative racial slurs and insults toward people of color. Those of you who have been my students and are people of color, when I think about microaggressions, I wonder how many times I've stepped on your toes with something that I didn't realize because of my own blindness, my own bias. Well, I have something for you. In your larger packet of information from me, there is a back page. It's called the Privilege Checklist. And Peggy McIntosh, the person who actually referenced on the other side, who said, privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, and visas, and et cetera. This is adapted from hers. If you look it up online, you can find it quite easily. It actually has 50 items. I see some of you know it and have been there. Would you take a moment right now and follow the instructions? Please read the list and place a check next to the items that apply to you or that you have encountered. Please do that now.
Am I checking for my white privilege
with
this as well?
I'm not sure how to answer that, Brenna. I'm hoping that everyone will get a fuller look at what I'm talking about as they go through this list. And privilege, of course, doesn't apply only to black-white situations, because there are ways in which everyone is privileged relative to someone else. So, Brenna, go through it, see what you find out there, and tell me later. Please.
Can I arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time? Like, I don't ever think of it like that. I mean, I may arrange to be in the company of people that happen to be of my race. Mm-hmm. I don't think of it like that.
If you wanted, I think maybe that's the point. If you wanted to get together with some folks tonight, would it be relatively easy to gather a group of white persons? Around and given your particular setting. And I suppose if you're a African-American student at Reformed Theological Seminary, it might not be as easy to arrange to be in the company of people that are mostly of the race. So, how you doing? Give you another couple of minutes while I'm that's me making all that racket. Sorry. Well, once you finish that, I think you have more of an idea what is meant in the literature by privilege and white privilege. And I keep running across authors that keep emphasizing, if you're a black person, America is a different America than it is for a white person. Now, I believe I could have said that and believed it or assented to it years ago. But it's coming across to me more clearly now. I was talking to an African-American student here at Reform Seminary, but kind of an elongated conversation. And our job was to learn about each other, get to know each other more deeply. And he said, you know, Dr. R, it's really weird being back in school again. He said, when I was real little, I loved school. And my mom and dad encouraged me to do well at school. And so I was in elementary school, third grade, and I was doing my homework, and I'd learned to read, and I was reading the books, and I knew the answers that the teacher, she would ask in class, and she'd ask a question, and I knew the answer, and I raised my hand, and she would ignore me. And she'd let someone else answer, and I'd raise my hand for the next one, and she would ignore me. And one day, just very soon in my academic experience of third grade, she pulled me aside and stood me in the corner. She said, "Stop being such a smart aleck." And she actually pulled my hair. And that became a regular feature, that when he was in class and he would raise his hand, she would stare at him and she'd come over and give his hair a yank. And he learned very quickly that black persons weren't supposed to be smart. And they certainly weren't supposed to be smarter than white persons in the class. And he began to get very anxious about school. He began to dislike school. And he said, yeah, my whole academic life took a turn from that point. And I started developing that African-American young man identity right then, back there. 8 years old, that just developed into more and more bitterness and anger and wouldn't try in school. And so he said, I'm pretty scared trying to come to school here at RTS. There's a lot of smart white people here. And I never had an experience like that. I never had a teacher discourage me from doing my homework and answering questions because someone else might be intimidated if I knew something. I never had anything even close to that. If I was in that same classroom with him, that'd be a very different classroom for me than it was for him. Well, we're going to do something a little different for a moment. Well, a few moments, actually. I would like you to leave everything here, and I'd like you to go out that door. I'm going to go with you, and go through the next door and stand out in the lawn. I think it's still fairly cool outside, so move rather quickly, please, and let's get outside. And then when you get outside in the yard, I just want a big circle.